Blog Talk Radio.
Companion, and this is the 15th day of December 2013, the 349th day of the year. It's 10 days until Christmas. It's a pleasure to have you back. Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here with you. I'm your host for the next little while, Dale Graham. And you can call me Graham because that's what my mom calls me. I hope you're sitting here with your favorite beverage in hand. Let me start this occasion off with a toast to each one of you. Do you mind? I hope this resonates just a little bit. You know, it's I'll say it straight out at this Christmas time of year. By God, I cannot flatter, I do defy the tongues of soothers, but a braver place in my heart's love hath no man than yourself. That's from Henry the Fourth, Part One. Andrew, you received a toast that from Shakespeare, and he's saying to us, I swear to you, I'm incapable of flattery. I've got no time for smooth talking, yes, men. But I will say this to you, and I do, in all sincerity. I hold no man in higher esteem than I do you. It's my brethren. Let's have some fun with that, eh? Yes, I've been on the road to recovery, and I'm. How does it? There's no way of no easy way of saying it. I am not very sick, since I can reason of it. It means if I'm still well enough to talk about it, I'm not that sick. And for a man my age to be talking about his health is plain boring. Nobody on the face of the earth gives a crap. Anyway, let's have this is an special time of year. This is coming up to the solstice, the longest night, and that's the 21st of December at 12:11 p.m. where you're going to be experiencing that interesting little phenom. This is an unusual time of year. Late dawn, early sunset, short day, long night. Up here in the northern hemisphere, the December solstice marks the longest night and the shortest day of the year, so make the most of it, of course. And in the southern hemisphere, they're celebrating the longest day and shortest night. No matter where you live in Earth's globe, it's your signal to celebrate. For us on the northern part, the shortest day is here. After this winter solstice, the days get longer. It's a seasonal shift that nearly everyone notices, since it links us with our distant past. And it happens for all of us at the same instance, everywhere on Earth. because that's the way it is. Same instance, different times on that time-space thing that we're trying to measure. That's better. A nice soothing beverage for the morning. A little bit of a nuisance here with this contraption. That does it. Anyway, earliest people on Earth knew that the sun cut a path across the sky, and they began to monitor, began to notice. That's all it was. There's nothing sinister about it or prescriptive. They began to notice things. They just didn't call it, didn't have a different kind of language for it. They built monuments, Stonehenge in England or Machu Picchu in Peru, places to follow the sun's yearly progress. But we see today, of course, I know you can't be convinced of anything because of the, except what seems reasonable to you. We know it's an astronomical event today, and we know it happens because of the Earth's tilt on its axis. It's sort of like we know more about it on a bigger scale, but it's still a pretty amazing event. And we know it's on its motion in an orbit around the sun. Pretty good. You have to admit that's a remarkable point of scale. We can picture it from the vantage point of space, which is kind of, if you think about it, it's amazing. And it's tilted on its axis 23.5 degrees. That's it, 23.5 degrees. Earth's northern and southern hemispheres trade places, receiving the sun's light and warmth almost directly. And then, it tilts the or wobbles back the other way. This is the time of year when, in the northern hemisphere, we're leaning further away from the sun for this year. At the December solstice, Earth is positioned in its orbit so that the sun stays below the North Pole horizon. So that's the 23.5 degree south of the equator, the imaginary line. All locations south of the equator have day lengths greater than 12 hours. And we have day lengths less than 12 hours. It's not a lot. So look for signs of, in the northern hemisphere, notice the late dawn. So the sun's coming up earlier and later, and the early sunsets. It's going to bed sooner and sooner. Around the time of this December solstice, it's your longest noontime shadow of the year. You could imagine it doesn't really seem all of that odd that we're celebrating something that has been part of mankind and societies from the earliest records and from our earliest imagination. We can only understand that survival depends even today on the sun. I don't think we may forget that. We may take it for granted, but nevertheless, it is true. We have a little thin atmosphere that keeps us safe and a magnetic element to our the planet that we're on. But we are vulnerable without the sun, which we know is burning out. There is not life. Interesting that I guess it shouldn't be interesting that we don't give it a second thought in the normal course of life around us. Some people do, and always will. You know, it's, what's kind of curious is it really doesn't matter whether we pay careful attention to it or not. It is a fact. And I think better that we understand, better those of us to keep these this notion alive than to for all of us to ignore things that are key to our existence. But, you know, not to be an alarmist, it's always been that way. Today, though, I wrote out a little, you know, outline for us to sort of frame our ideas. How to own brilliant ideas and make them work was the little gemstone that came to my mind. Trying to be the source of all truths has become difficult in the 21st century. I subscribe to that kind of thinking. Describing a good life can be a red flag for ferrets who are intent on finding discrepancies with their own point of view. See, if you tell me, you know, what the elements are of a good life, the ferrets will always, because they're bright enough, will always find discrepancies in whatever you say. They're like a spoiler alert. And we can never be sure if they're cynics. We learn not to trust them, because we can never tell whether they're, you know, saying something to be provocative or whether they truly believe it and they can substantiate it, you know, or it's something very glib. So laying it out there, you can expect that. Expect criticism. And here's a little interesting phenomena. When somebody's talking to you and, you know, a brother is talking to you and criticizing, you know, listen to the pattern of criticism about other people, other Masons, other our brethren. Because if he's speaking that way about other people, you know that's the way he speaks about you when you're not there. No, don't go, you know, just pulling your hair out and running down the street screaming. Come on, get a spine and grow up here. It's a barometer. It's the shallowness. Better that we know it. I always think so. Better that I know the capability and the character of a fellow around me than be foolhardy about it. But it doesn't mean the person can't have redeeming features. Just they are who they are. Even disclaimers can be brushed aside. If you were to say, this is what I think a good life is, and you put out your reasons in a reasonable, common sense kind of way, they can all be dismissed. Common sense is probably the most prominent disclaimer that's discarded. You know, that capability that we have within ourselves that seems to be too often ignored at our own peril. Being a good person on this planet, whatever that measure is in your mind, is no guarantee of being popular. And being popular is no guarantee of rightness or the moral high ground. My goodness. One of the things that craft does well is confronting us with a need to live a factual life. Look at the facts. This is hard. It's a challenge. Oh, well, you wanted easy. You didn't join Freemasonry, that's for sure. Easier said than done, I think. While I enjoy the Hellenistic philosophies, today, positivism prevails. Fans of the program, you know, regular listeners, will know that the Hellenistics are the Epicurean, Skeptic, and Stoic notions. I like those. But what was difficult was, you know, how could you possibly measure the effectiveness? Well, you know, in our day and age of scientific reason, we can't just have something that speculative. We have to have something measurable. If you can't prove it, it doesn't work. That's our credo today. But I harken back to a time when I'm, you know, addressing questions about my own character and trying to live a reasonable, stable life and do the best I can. And I think because, you know, it seemed to me very pronounced and in front of me every time I walk in the Masonic Lodge. This is a work in progress. Freemasons must seem like lords a-leaping as they plunge headlong into espousing faith in subscript philosophies. Eh? Think about how the outside world must think about us. Here we have beliefs and things that may not be, you know, consistent with the positivism. That's the philosophy that prevails today. We have beliefs in ideas that are still difficult. I won't say we can't prove them, but we don't currently have ways of necessarily measuring all of them. So we must seem a bit daft to some. And it's not, whether we do or not, has nothing to do with our good intention. No matter acts, no matter the good intention, can poison even the most solid relationship if the recipient does not welcome them. Rash emotional judgment, rash comments are ingredients of conflicts. Freemasonry points this out constantly. But it does it in metaphor. Throughout history, chauvinism, being high-minded, has been toxic. That's chauvinism. We generally just toss that out as it means male. Well, it doesn't. Being high-minded. Enter the man who has reached an age of balance. Old enough to develop his own thoughts, yet young enough that they are relevant. No sense coming up with a way of seeing the world that was more fitting 75 years ago than 5 years into the future. Aha, we'll come back to that one. Who will attempt the impossible to control his emotion and learn to master the capacity for silence when he does not know what to say? The impossible tasks. Huh? Maybe that's my holy grail. Maybe that's your holy grail. Learn to control our emotion to find that contentment. Learn to be quiet and shrug our shoulders rather than having to take on every conflicted idea around us. To what end? We're sure to change the attitudes of some loutish person? No. People believe what they want to believe. But we influence by doing things perhaps that are uncharacteristic. As I age and begin repeating stories of glory days, don't mock nor pity me too much. The journey is always far more interesting than the just destination. Now, how can you possibly say that that isn't a fact? It doesn't change ability, but it does let us enhance the abilities that we have by hard work, listening, paying attention, and keeping quiet as we go about our business. Of course, aude vide tace. Of course, I need your advice on this. So join me. Help me. Bring it on. I need your advice. Oh, you think I'm kidding? Those of you who know me now don't think I'm kidding. They know darn well. Mm-hmm. Coming up to, can I talk a little bit about some Christmassy things? Yeah. Bringing that bearing to the world around you? Are you? The spirit of Christmas. If you have a long face and a longer, darker mood, perhaps you have forgotten that the joy that you're looking for is around. It's within you. you bring it. I don't mean confronting, being angry about it. If that's your nature, if that's your temperament, well, pity you. Silly. You can be wring your hands and fret and be concerned about, dreadful things happening, but it doesn't change the probabilities of things happening any more than if you live a content life, have a smile on your face. You can take yourself seriously either way. When it's necessary, not necessarily solemn, though. We're not funeral directors. This is life. Serious, but we can have a smile on our face. Of course we can. So we come up to the notion that that spirit of Christmas comes from inside you. Especially, I expect that of Freemasons, can't I? Better to leave the auditorium now, as they would say. Something is expected of us. Yeah, of course it is. Of course it is. We're expected to bring an influence, to bring that the unusual into the conversation. What is usual? People grumbling and complaining and feeding off that. That's pretty commonplace. That I think it's fairly lowbrow, but it is commonplace. To be able to walk in and turn that around, that's a Masonic influence. To do that without being presumptuous is essential to our order. Isn't that the highest form of our work? I'm using the term charity. Before it was translated into giving nickels out of your pocket into the hand of somebody else. I'm thinking more about the term as it was written and probably intended, an act of some type of murky love, respect, honor of other people, of our friends, agape. Hard to dismiss these types of things. Well, yeah, but we are getting into Christmas. There's no denying it. I'm going to talk a little bit. Who knew the 12 days of Christmas are the time between Christmas and Epiphany? I had this notion that here we are, the 12 days before Christmas leading up to it. It's probably the most misunderstood part of the church year among Christians who are not part of the liturgical traditions. Contrary to popular belief, these are not the 12 days before, but in most of the Western church are the 12 days from Christmas until the Epiphany, 6th of January. The 12 days count from December 25th until the 5th, of course. And the Epiphany, do your homework on that. In some traditions, the first day of Christmas begins on the evening of December 25th, with the following day being considered the first day of Christmas. In these traditions, the 12 days begin on the 26th. The origin and counting of the 12 days is complicated and is related to differences in calendars. Again, I apologize to my Jewish and Muslim friends I'm just trying to think. I won't try and recite all of the different faiths of friends of mine, for fear that I'll miss one and I'll feel bad about that. But I apologize, and I only speak about the faith that I was brought up and trained in, so I am limited that way. But I hope you'll respect that. I assume that within your own faith you have some very similar and parallel beliefs. We're all, after all, under the skin, very similar, the same. In the Western Church, Epiphany is celebrated as the time when the wise men, or magi, arrived to present gifts to the young Jesus. Traditionally, there were three magi, probably from the fact of three gifts, even though the biblical narrative never says how many magi came. You know, that's the rascal of it all. When our historians start to look closely at what's said, it's like we filled in the blanks with some pretty interesting and unsubstantiated pieces. Now I think the neurology is starting to help us understand how that happened. That wasn't just conning. That has something to do with us, with the way our brains function. In some cultures, especially Hispanic and Latin, it's observed, the 6th of January is observed as the Three Kings Day, or simply Day of the Kings. Even though December 25th is celebrated as Christmas, January 6th is often the day for giving gifts in the Hispanic and Latin cultures. In some places, it is traditional to give Christmas gifts for each of the 12 days of Christmas. Since Eastern Orthodox traditions use a different religious calendar, they celebrate Christmas on January 7th and observe Epiphany or Theophany on January 19th. In the 16th century, some European and Scandinavian cultures had combined the 12 days of Christmas with sometimes pagan festivals. That's a term that just popped out of the Roman Catholicism. So if you want to know the root of that one, that's politics. the 12 days was celebrating the changing of the year. These are usually associated with driving away evil spirits for the start of the new year. You know, the evil spirits that kill our crops and drop the temperature and freeze our water and cause the land to be covered with snow. And if we've lived a right life and provided for the needs of our gods, the shortest night will pass and heat will be restored. The sun will come back to us and bring life. In some church traditions, January 5th is considered the 11th day of Christmas, while the evening of the 5th is still counted as the 12th day. Many European cultures celebrate the 12th night, including a king's cake, remembering the visit of the Magi, and, oh my goodness, ale or wine. A king's cake is part of the observance of Mardi Gras in French Catholic culture in the southern United States. In some cultures, the king's cake was part of the celebration of the Epiphany. Popular song, The 12 Days of Christmas, is usually seen as simply a nonsense song for children with secular origins. However, some have suggested that this is a song of Christian instruction, perhaps dating to the 16th century religious wars in England, with hidden references to the basic teachings of the Christian faith. They contend that it was a mnemonic device to teach the catechism to children. The true love mentioned in the song is not an earthly suitor, but refers to God. The me who receives the presents refers to every baptized person who is part of the faith. Each of the days represents some aspect of the faith that was important for children to learn. However, many have questioned the historical accuracy of this origin of the song, while some have tried to debunk it as an urban myth out of the personal agendas. Others have tried to deal with this account of the song's origin in the name of historical accuracy. There is little hard evidence available either way. The reality is the evidence for both perspectives is mostly in logical deduction and probabilities. Lack of positive evidence does not automatically provide negative evidence. On the other hand, logical deduction and probability do not provide proof either. The view of the song as a secret catechism is most likely legendary or anecdotal. Without corroboration or the absence of substantive evidence, we probably should not take overly rigid positions. On the first day of Christmas, my true love gave to me. There you go. A little bit of Christmas cheer. Do you mind if I talk then? I want to chat. I suppose I can. Well, you go right ahead, Dale. You've got the microphone. I want to talk about our history. seems like this time of year, you know, at this time of year, want to have a glass of something celebratory in my hand. Good company, good conversation. I want to just reflect. I'd like you to take a moment to invite you to reflect on the positive things that have happened in your life over the past 349 days. Not so much the challenges. If you lived a life without a challenge, you'd be boring as hell, and I probably wouldn't want you wouldn't be tuning in here. No, I expect that you you faced your challenges. And some, are, I would expect, are more inconvenient than others. And that they're fit and proper challenges for you. Because every one of us has our own version of them, our own accounting. So I want to go back to a period of history. Just talk a little bit about history. Is it okay? And let me skip through. I want to... Premier Grand Lodge, later known as the Moderns, was the only body of duly constituted masonry to take an interest in America prior to 1755. Now, is that so? This is the version that I'm using today. But is that so? I don't know. But if you're looking through the lens of the Premier Grand Lodge of Canada, of England, it's probably, you know, gee, yeah, we were first to take an interest. Let's just see. The big Lodge of Kilwinning, Mother Kilwinning in Scotland, withdrew from the Grand Lodge of Scotland and acted as an independent warranting body from 1743 to 1807. It chartered several lodges in Virginia between 1755 and 1758. Was the only body of duly constituted masonry to take an interest in America. And then we hear Kilwinning was chartering lodges. Now, just to be a little bit clear, this notion of withdrawing from the Grand Lodge of Scotland, well, before the Grand Lodge of Scotland existed, before the Premier Grand Lodge of England existed, Kilwinning Lodge existed, and it was chartering other lodges. There wasn't a Grand Lodge. There you have it. So it wasn't like they withdrew. It's like they went back to doing what they were doing in the first place. The Grand Lodge of Ireland warranted no civilian lodges in the colonies before the Revolution, but was the largest issuer of traveling warrants to regimental lodges. The earliest military lodge to work in America was No. 85, Irish Constitution, in Frampton's 30th Regiment of Foot, and it was stationed at the garrison in Louisbourg, Cape Breton. My friend Terry Crowley, Professor Crowley, did his PhD on the fort, Louisbourg. So he reminded me, if it's in English, it's Louisbourg. But he claimed that it was originally a French fort, went back and forth, of course. And in that case, Louisbourg. A little piece of trivia. He was, Professor Crowley spent a lot of, a long and distinguished career as a chairman of the Department of History at a local Ontario University. But just a little side note there. The Grand Lodge of Scotland founded lodges at Blandford, Virginia, and at Boston in 1756. Subsequently, other Scottish lodges were formed in the southern colonies. And don't get pushy. I'm coming up to Canada. Come on. The Grand Lodge of England, in bracket ancients, established a provincial Grand Lodge in Nova Scotia in 1757, which began to warrant lodges within the 13 colonies. In 1758, the ancients and their allies were hostile to the moderns, and in several colonies there were rival Grand Lodges. Ooh, they make that sound like it's a bad thing. It's a little too much testosterone on the page here for this, for me. They existed, but they coexisted. My gosh, what is it, 41 years? It wasn't like they went around, these are gentlemen. It wasn't like they went around. And in fact, we know that some people, some Masons, were members of the ancients and operated members of lodges that operated under both. So this notion of rivalry, all right, let's say maybe it was a governance issue, but at a street level, there was a civility. So I just don't want you to get the notion that this was a mudslinging event, because it's, somebody taking license. But in 1813, on the eastern side of the Atlantic, the ancients and moderns finally amalgamated to form the United Grand Lodge of England. Ugly. United Grand Lodge of England. Yeah, so, and, you know, interesting reasons why, you know, subtleties, careful subtleties, reason through. So, and important enough that there was no rush to get into it, into, you know, there was a split. You go your way, or go ours. But we never heard that anyone was at any side or any point was definitive this was a permanent schism. The first provincial Grand Lodge in Upper Canada. Woo-woo! The provincial Grand Lodge of Upper Canada owed its existence to the zeal and enthusiasm of a number of brethren in Quebec. The most notable was Brother Alexander Wilson. There were in that province three lodges which held their warrants from the ancient Grand Lodge of England. These lodges felt that the craft in England would be much more prosperous if there were a governing body on this side of the Atlantic Ocean. Accordingly, Brother Wilson requested the Grand Lodge to warrant a provincial Grand Lodge for Canada. The brethren assumed that there would be a single provincial Grand Master for Canada and a substitute Grand Master for each of Upper and Lower Canada. Ah, but this is Canada. And in 1791, the Constitutional Act divided Canada politically into Upper and Lower Canada, and the Grand Lodge chose to follow this pattern. Now, on the 7th of March of 1792, the Grand Lodge named His Royal Highness Prince Edward as Provincial Grand Master for Lower Canada and William Jarvis as Provincial Grand Master or Substitute Grand Master for Upper Canada. Although both men had the title Provincial Grand Master, only Prince Edward was given the authority to issue warrants for lodges, whereas Jarvis could only grant dispensations for the holding of lodges. There's a clever division of responsibilities, isn't it? Let's just stop and ponder the committee or the brain that pulled that one apart. Jeez. The earliest record of activity was not until July 1795, when a meeting of the Provincial Grand Lodge was called in Niagara. In 1797, the seat of government for Upper Canada was moved from Niagara to York. All right, I won't get into that being Toronto. Swampy, must have been, that's when it was swampy and the docks, the pens were, the stockyards were still, you know, down by the docks. Jarvis, as a government official for Upper Canada, moved to York as well. He took with him his warrant as provincial grand master, and this created a problem. Without the warrant, the Brethren of Niagara could not legally act as a provincial grand lodge. Due to the long absence and indifference of Jarvis, the Brethren of Niagara elected and installed Brother George Forsyth as provincial grand master in December 1802 to replace Jarvis, thus creating the schismatic Grand Lodge of Niagara. 1802. Okay? So, interesting times. Several factors. And, I must say, I need to go and look and see if George Forsyth, how that is reckoned with Grand Masters. On our records. A great rift arose when the Brethren decided to form a Grand Lodge of their own and declared themselves independent of the Mother Grand Lodge. It's like, well, the hell with you. You know, you've taken your time. You've got things divided up so that it's completely unworkable. You're ignoring our needs. We're sending over remittances, and you're not even cashing them. You're not even, acknowledging. You're not even sending back your acknowledgement that these people have been made members of a Masonic Lodge, so they can't travel. And this wasn't just going on for months and months and months. It was going on for years. I think we could see where Niagara, good Masons, strong Masons, just as they are today, very knowledgeable. somebody had to get fed up, and a great rift arose. And so they declared themselves, you know, independent. That's it. We'll do it ourselves. Okay, we've got it. We know the ritual, and we're good and strong and sturdy, forthright Masons. Over the next 20 years, officers were elected and installed, and their Grand Lodge issued 10 warrants for new lodges, all in the Niagara Peninsula and Western Ontario. As these actions were irregular from the point of view of strict Masonic jurisprudence, hardly one of the English lodges in the province was working under proper authority. The new provincial Grand Master, Simon McGilvery, arrived in Canada on July 1822. There you go, 20 years later. There's a rush. There's a bloody concern by the Home Office, eh? He was an able man, and let me be generous to England. They had a bit of a handful going on with wars, not to be unkind to their cause or their situation. He was an able man, was this Simon McGilvery, an experienced Mason, but a grim set of problems confronted him. The first provincial Grand Master, Jarvis, had been empowered to only grant one-year dispensations for the holding of lodges. This just gets better, doesn't it? But not to issue warrants. Ah. Not only had he, in defiance of the terms of his patent, granted warrants, but he had neglected to enter his lodges in the register of Grand Lodge. You know what they don't know would hurt him, them, us. A firm hand was needed, but in a velvet glove. I like that. Firm hand may be more decisive. So we see that Jarvis was bending over backwards, wasn't he? He granted warrants. And what is this one-year dispensation? My God, man, Joe. I kind of like, you know, I like the more, you know. All right. Jarvis was what he was, but firm hand. Within 4 months, McGilvery had brought order out of chaos and restored brotherly love across the province. In 1823, the Book of Constitutions was printed in Kingston. Ah, I just love this part. I just think this is remarkable, the history of the Grand Lodge. In a circular prepared in September 1855, the following list of grievances was set forth and subsequently given wider currency. The first and most important is the diversity of interests and the want of harmony in action and in working, resulting from the growth in the province of lodges hailing from the grand lodges of different countries, thus perpetuating the local national feelings and prejudices and conflicting interests and consequent estrangement of affection amongst the brethren of an order that knows no country and is confined to no race. Hear, hear. That's our boy Sam. Excellent. Now that's thought. That is Masonic. The second is the manifest injustice of lodges in this province being required out of their limited means to contribute to the accumulated funds of the Grand Lodge of England. So, are you reading this? We're supporting benevolence in England. Yes, they needed it, but we have our own needs. The idea of a nation was growing, wasn't it? In addition to having to support a provincial Grand Lodge, so this was double dipping. And especially as the great proportion of claims for Masonic assistance that are daily and hourly occurring in this province are made by brethren immigrating from the mother country, while instances of Masons leaving this for England in a position to require such relief are rare, if they ever occur at all. So you're looking at the balance, the movement, Masons coming from there to here, needing help, compared to the numbers going from here to there. It looks like Canada had more appeal because people were coming from there, for whatever reason. Just as it is today, I like to think. Good place here. So somebody was saying, boys, we're getting screwed. We're paying everywhere. Now, gee, has that changed? I don't think that I can't apply that kind of comment to what's going on at Grand Lodge. I think we're so, so modest. And what they ask of us financially. maybe if we're a reading of this history, it gives us an idea. We've got an idea why. So we're supporting. The Grand Lodge of England thus doubly taxed the fraternity here by transferring to these shores numberless claimants for Masonic benevolence at the same time that they are receiving from us a portion of our means of affording that assistance. So here's what the boys are saying. All right, the guys are getting off the boat and they need help. But you're already taxing us and we're paying for benevolence for those guys. What are you doing with the money? The third is the inconvenience arising from the lengthened periods that must elapse in consequence of the distance between us and the Grand Lodge of England before we can receive replies to our communications, sanctions to our proceedings, warrants, certificates, did you get that? Of membership, etc. Cases of emergency. And instances have often occurred of brethren being deprived of the privileges of the craft by leaving their foreign countries before the arrival of the certificates, for which it must be borne in mind they had paid previously to their initiation. So I'm being initiated here. I've got business over there. Where's my certificate? Boat's sailing. I get on the boat. I go to carry on my business. And my certificate is still on transit back into Canada. And I've already paid for it. I've already paid. I'm fully, I paid for my initiation, you know. This disadvantage is acknowledged and complied with, but which unhappily is far from being the case. Important communications have frequently remained without reply for months, and in some cases for years, greatly to the inconvenience of the fraternity here. And notwithstanding that complaints of such neglect have been repeatedly represented to the Grand Lodge of England through the regular channel of communication, but also by resolutions of the Provincial Grand Lodge through the Grand Registrar of England, they have as yet received no attention or redress. A neglect highly discourteous toward the Masons of Canada and seriously injurious to the general interests of the craft. Hear, hear. Hear, hear. And well said. The last, but to our estimation, by no means the least of the alleged grievances, is the appointment of our provincial Grand Master by the Grand Master of England, which virtually leaves the appointment in the hands of Masons in England, who at a distance of nearly 4,000 miles may reasonably be expected to be practically ignorant of the social position and requirements of the craft in Canada. And inasmuch as the provincial grand officers are nominated by the provincial grand master, the efficiency or inefficiency of the administration of our affairs depends entirely upon the eligible or ineligible selection of the provincial grand master made for us by the Grand Master of England. And this selection is made without reference to the opinions of the fraternity in Canada. As to the Masonic zeal or interest in the craft, attainments and general qualifications of the nominee, although they would naturally be the best informed on the subject and most deeply interested in the result. The Provincial Grand Lodge thus constituted is placed in the equivocal position of being responsible to and independent of the craft in Canada, whilst experience has shown that body to be unable to secure from the Grand Lodge of England the attention and due respect to their position of Provincial Grand Lodge. William Mercer Wilson observed, "A Grand Lodge cannot create a Grand Lodge. If independence was to be achieved, there was no alternative to rebellion. The die was cast in Hamilton on the 10th of October, 1855. A notice of the meeting was communicated to every lodge in Canada, and just under half sent delegates to Hamilton. A resolution was presented and passed. Other declaration was adopted, which was recorded in the minutes as, I'll just quote, it's just a little paragraph. It was then moved by Worship of Brother G.L. Allen of King Solomon's Toronto, seconded by Worship of Brother William Bell House of Strict Observance, Hamilton, and unanimously adopted that we, the representatives of regularly warranted lodge, here in convention assembled, resolve that the Grand Lodge of Ancient Free and Accepted Masons of Canada be and is hereby formed upon the ancient charges and constitution of Masonry, under the chairmanship of William Mercer Wilson, a new constitution was prepared and duly adopted. Most of the historical information in this came from Whence Come We, and is made available mainly for the purpose of education of the new candidate. So there you have it. Good. Excellent. Did it give you a little bit of a sense? It wasn't that we just went about our business and without some pressure. And you know, when you think about it, I find it very straining that this is an experience. This is, you know, showing by experience, by behavior, how I'm to think differently as a Mason. It's different, isn't it? Easier just to, I guess, get you know, all muscular and whatever, carry on and start to, that's it, just carry on foolishly with temper. But there's no honor in that. And I'd like to think that the way this was handled has led us to an honorable position that we can respect to this day, and that the Brethren of the United Grand Lodge of England can respect to this day. We have strong and positive relationships. And there is, with the passage of time, there has been and there is continued growth. And that, after all, is important and vital for all Freemasons. This is the... I'm going to move on here a little bit. You okay with that? This is the 200th anniversary of the Holy Royal Arch of Freemasonry, 1813. So, interesting times. I want to talk a little bit more about, do you remember what we were getting into last week? Doing how to live well. Helping all you stalwart Freemasons to manage your life and without the recriminations of and self-recriminations, how to gain more from the experience. I think it's it works if we can absorb just a little bit more from the Greeks, just a little bit more. Remember, we were talking about the Stoics and Epicureans, and remember the question that we pose for ourselves is how to live a good life. I have a little bit of fun. So, let's see what we've got. I don't know if it's fitting to break this up with some poetry, but I suppose I can get away with that a little bit, can I? I don't know if I want to get into all of this. I'll deal with something from the Free Zone. There you go. You want to look at something really interesting. There's a a website for Pinner, P-I-N-N-E-R, Pinner Lodge number 3300. Yeah, do yourself a favor. It's a Masonic website, and it is man. Well, I'm not even going to try and describe it. Check it out for yourself, and you'll see there are some dangerous minds amongst the brethren. These guys are this is just they're out there, okay? Some years back, just after the introduction of random breath testing, the police officers of a small town had to show the community that the tests were working, and they decided to stake out the local Masonic Hall. And as the night wore on, Mason slowly came down the stairs and got into one boy got in his car. The moment he started the engine, two officers jumped over and said, blow into this. And of course he did, but to the amazement of officers, it proved negative. And they thought, oh, gee, this machine is buggered. So they tried it again, but same thing happened. But they were sure that they were going to nail this guy, so they escorted him to the police station to do a blood test. And it proved negative. But by this time they were beside themselves. You know the boys in uniform being what they are. Oh, we got it. But then they asked him what had gone on and what he had done that evening. And he said, oh, the Grand Master was there and the Grand Secretary is there and the Grand Stewards were there. And we all had a great time. And my job, I was the Grand Decoy. no, come on, Abe. That was good. That's the Grand Decoy. All right. That works, hey? Small town, little Lodge was having, bad luck, and it was preparing to initiate a candidate, and it was a hot night, you know the type. No air conditioning, and everybody's sort of very proud that they've never had an air conditioner. So you've got the old boys under serious pulmonary distress, and nobody's having a good time. And then, of course, we want to smile and put a candidate through that. Ugh. So after sweating their way through the work, the master asked the candidate what he desired most, and the guy said, a beer. And at the conjunction, the master, he was a bit startled, and he whispered, light. So the candidate said, okay, a light beer. No, that's good. No. one more, and then we'll go on. Too much levity, too much, we can't have too much fun. There was one of the boys was having trouble with his ritual and was telling a fellow, boys are out and having a drink. And his friend said that he knew a guy who sells parrots that know all the ritual and they can prompt him when he has any trouble. So the next day they went off to the shop and the guy says, yeah, I have three. And he pulled the curtain and there were three parrots. One had a Master Mason's apron on and one had a master's apron and the third had a Grand Lodge apron on. How much is the one with the master's apron on? And the shopkeeper said, well, that's $2,000. And he knows all the ritual, including the inner workings, and it'll prompt you whenever you get stuck. No, said the Mason, that's too expensive. What about the one with the other apron on? Well, that one's only $1,000, and he knows all the ritual, not all, is some of it, but not the inner workings, and he'll prompt you when you get stuck. How about the one with the Grand Lodge apron on? Well, you can have him for $10. Why so cheap? He must know all the ritual and everything. Oh, yeah, he says he knows all the ritual, but when you make a mistake, all he does is sit there and shakes his head. So that's, come on, that's, I know, sorry, too much. Remember that one, that's a good one, that's a, three parrots, there we go, shake its head. I don't know, they're out there shaking their head, you're all shaking your heads right now, sorry. I'll get back. So I want to talk to you about our friend Marcus. Marcus Aurelius, and he kept notebooks. He was a Stoic. So his notebooks were, we jump all over those puppies. And he would never go over the changes of perspective he wished to drill. He would go over, he wrote them down. And these were the things that changed. He wanted to change his perspective. That's what we're talking about here with just to get back into this, Epicurean and the Stoics and the Skeptics, it's really changing our perspective, the way we look at the world around us. And the point of doing that was that we would live a life, the person doing that would live a life with less conflict and less, nonsense and wasted time, wasted effort and distress. So that has appeal for anybody. And I think today, when I was starting to read this into Masonic Companion, it has a great deal of appeal for us today. Even though we've moved toward that period of celebrity, away from the period of developing character. So Aurelius kept notes, and we have them. So and this is what he would say to himself: how good it is when you have roast meat or such foods before you to impress in your mind that this is the dead body of a fish, the dead body of a pig or a bird, and again, that the Falernian wine is the mere juice of grapes. Falernian, good wine. And that your purple-edged robe, simply the hair of sheep soaked in shellfish blood. At other times, he imagined flying up to the heavens so he could gaze down and see how insignificant all human concerns were from such a distance. Yeah. You know, we find that we're in the midst of some type of intense discussion, and then something truly significant happens, and all of our efforts seem so truthfully petty. That's, if that doesn't change our attitude, then we're fools. Seneca did this too. Place before your mind's eye the vast spread of time's abyss, he said, and consider the universe, and then contrast our so-called human life with infinity. You know, really that important, eh? It's all about me. Are we so clearly narcissistic? You know, the only way we can see and understand life is as if everybody has to see the world the way we see it. That's what we've come to. That's the mindset of a two-year-old. I don't accept that that's the way men function. Although, sadly, we've seen some fellas act that way. Another practice of the Stoics was to visualize time circling around on itself over aeons. Socrates would be born again and would teach in Athens just as he did the first time. Every butterfly would flap its wings in the same way. Every cloud would pass overhead at the same speed. You yourself would live again and have all the same thoughts and emotions before, as before, again and again without end. This apparently terrifying idea brought comfort, because, like the other ideas, it showed one's own fleeting troubles at a reduced size. I like that. My problems are not that great. There's always somebody with greater difficulties. And it's really easy for me to, for any one of us, to bring that thought to mind. And then to re-examine our own position. Who's the bigger man? At the same time, doing this, everything that we've done will come back to haunt us. Everything mattered. You know, when you have that notion that you're going to relive this, the notion of, you know, over and over time is going to repeat itself, well, everything we do then matters. Nothing was flushed away. Nothing could be forgotten. Meditating on this forced you to pay more attention to how you lived your everyday life. It posed a challenge. But it also led to a kind of acceptance to what the Stoics called amor fati, or love of fate. As Epictetus, the Stoic, wrote, "Do not seek to have everything that happens happen as you wish, but wish for everything to happen as it actually does happen, and your life will be serene." So wish that everything that does happen happens exactly as it does. Don't try and intrude and have the world adapt to your wishes. You'll never be serene. See, the notion here is serenity. One should be able to accept everything as it is willingly without going into the futile longing to change it. Montaigne seemed to find this trick easy. This is 16th century guy, dude, and it came to him by nature. If I had to live over again, he wrote cheerfully, I would live as I have lived. But most people had to practice it. And this was where the mental exercises came in. Want the tricks? You deserve the tricks. You know, you've waited and you've put up with enough. You've put up with enough today. Seneca had an extreme trick for practicing amor fati. Remember? The love of fates. Whatever the fates bring, you love. He was asthmatic, and attacks brought him almost to the point of suffocation. Poor fellas. He often felt that he was about to die, but he learned to use each attack as a philosophical opportunity. While his throat closed and his lungs strained for breath, he tried to embrace what was happening to him as to say yes to it. I will this, he would think, and if necessary, I will myself to die from it. When the attack receded, he emerged feeling stronger, for he had done battle with fear and defeated it. Stoics were especially keen on pitiless mental rehearsals of all the things they dreaded most. Yuck. Do I like this? Okay. Epicureans were more inclined to turn their vision away from terrible things, to concentrate on what was more positive. A Stoic behaves like a man who tenses his stomach muscles and invites an opponent to punch them. An Epicurean prefers to invite no punches, and when bad things happen, simply to step out of the way. If Stoics are boxers, Epicureans are closer to Oriental martial arts practitioners. Montaigne found the Epicurean approach more congenial in most situations, and he took their ideas even further. He claimed to envy lunatics because they were always mentally somewhere elsewhere, an extreme form of Epicurean deflection. What did it matter if a madman's idea of the world was skewed so long as he was happy? Montaigne retold classical stories such as that of Lycus, who went about his daily life and successfully held down a job while believing that everything he saw was taking place on stage as a theatrical performance. When a doctor cured him of this delusion, Lycus became so miserable that he sued the doctor for robbing him of his pleasure in life. Similarly, the man named Thrasyllus nurtured the belief that every ship that came in and out of his local port at Piraeus was carrying wonderful cargoes just for him. He was happy all the time, for he rejoiced each time a ship came safely to port and did not seem to worry that the cargoes never materialized. Alas, his brother Crito had his delusion treated, and that was the end of it. Not everyone can have the benefit of being insane. But everyone can make life easier for themselves by turning down the beam of their reason slightly. With grief in particular, Montaigne learned that he could not recover simply by talking himself out of it. He did try Stoic tricks, and he was not afraid to focus his attention on La Boétie's death, his close friend's death, long enough to write his account of it. But most of the time he found it more helpful to divert his attention to something else altogether. A painful notion takes hold of me, he said. I find it quicker to change it than to subdue it. I substitute a contrary one for it, or, if I cannot at all events, a different one. Variation always solaces, dissolves, and dissipates. If I cannot combat it, I escape it, and in fleeing, I dodge. I am tricky. And he used the same technique to help others. He once tried to console a woman who was, unlike some widows, he implies, genuinely suffering grief for her dead husband. He's suggesting a disingenuous widow. It's like, thank God he's gone. So he's seeing somebody that's seriously grieving. He first considered the more usual philosophical methods, reminding her that nothing can be gained from lamentation or persuading her that she might never have met her husband anyway. But he settled on a different trick, very gently deflecting her talk and diverting it bit by bit to subjects nearby, then a little more remote. The widow seemed to pay little attention at first, but in the end, the other subjects caught her interest. Thus, without her realizing what was happening, he wrote, I imperceptibly stole away from her this painful thought and kept her in good spirits and entirely soothed for as long as I was there. He admitted that this did not go to the root of her grief, but it got her through an immediate crisis and presumably allowed time to begin its own natural work. There you have it. I like that. The idea of changing perspectives and finding relief. Can we learn it? I like to think so. Something to learn from the past. Lots to learn from the past. I think we'll have a little more. Can I talk to you about, do you mind if I talk to you just in closing about what I want to learn about? Enough of the Greeks, eh? Enough. I've given material on Plato and philosophy. We've had, we can set that aside. I'll finish up with just a little bit on the from this really interesting book by Giles Morgan, Freemasonry: Its History and Myths Revealed. How much of this, how much of the information about Freemasonry is really out there, and how much of it is revealing? I find it just articles floating. In my mind, Freemasonry has gone from, the lodge is being redefined in the 21st century. You and I now are communicating through networks of different systems where we can share ideas. And the downside of this is that people that have really twisted points of view can go out there and talk with and find, there's somewhere in the planet, there's someone else with a twisted point of view. We'll eventually find them out, of course. But what it also allows us to do is gain a perspective on this thoughtful conversation that's going on around the world. Maybe what are we looking at? About 4 million Freemasons. I like to think that we are starting to make a connection through communication that we couldn't through ritual or through governance. That sense of universal Freemasonry that was attempted was looked at seriously in our past, but it just proved so difficult. Unlike a lot of things, if we try and implode problems, if we try and, inject ideas, I think we're always going to be quite frustrated. But like everything else, and I particularly think this way as sort of the root or part of the foundation for our College of Freemasonry, that we don't create an appetite. We feed an appetite for learning that's there in the man. We do that through inspiration and through providing information that he feels he requires. Other than that, it's an indoctrination. We're telling people how to learn and what to learn. When there's an appetite, the information is just absorbed. And we see so many people coming to our shores, having grown up in an area. If you have ever lived in an area or lived in circumstance where, you know, money was short, you know that the difference between poverty and being poor, you know, you also know about the threat of hunger and going without. Well, you appreciate plenty. When that occurs, you appreciate it. Living in an area where there's not opportunity, when you find an area where there is opportunity, you take it damn seriously. Oh my, I'm just describing ancient and accepted Freemasonry, and at least in the mind of a lot of people. It's an opportunity. Let me talk to you. Can I talk to you about some pillars? Do you mind? Oh, you know, we come from a curious time. Couldn't just build a pillar. You had to name it, didn't you? The pillars cast by harm and set up at the vestibule. Oh, here's something I want to help with before I go on. I was talking to some fellows the other night over in Collingwood. A great night. They're the Georgian District's Wardens Association had invited me to talk. They are just, the reception was just absolutely incredible. These are strong, strong Masons, very, very well schooled and progressive. Man, they hold it together, very respectful, very dutiful. And I think in my mind they do it right. But and I want to thank them for their hospitality and very generous comments. But I challenged the young officers, when they were doing the work, you know, to think of themselves on the stage as Stratford instead of, you know, them, their exit off the stage being the most important thing. It's the primary character. The primary character in a ritual isn't the officers. It's the candidate. And the work is being done not by all these fellows prancing around. It's being done by the master, the lodge. These other people are proxies. So they're really, really, and of course they would say that themselves. It's not their night, their line. They're conveying a bit of the ritual. So I challenge, here's what I challenge these fellows. What character were they in when they did their ritual? Like, I don't do the ritual. It's not Dale's ritual. The ritual is woven together. But what character? What character am I in when I'm doing the second? Am I, you know, is it Noah? Is it Moses? Is it Hiram of Tyre? What character? Socrates? Pythagoras? And then once I understand that, then I can begin to translate that, or interpret, not translate, I can begin to interpret, to give some definition to the ritual. In the way that it's presented, not, my gosh, go about changing things before we understand them. That's not going to happen. So here we have Hiram, and he's set up at the vestibule of the temple. Remember, I talked to you about Solomon's temple, having this very special symbolic significance within the iconography of Freemasonry. Well, that's very valid. And their important symbolism and meaning is explained to candidates during the rituals of the first and second degree. Yeah. He cast two pillars of bronze, 18 cubits was the height of one, and a cord of 12 cubits would encircle it. And the second pillar was the same. And he set up the pillars of the vestibule of the temple. And he set up the pillar on the south and called it Jachin. And he set up the pillar on the north and he called it Boaz. Boaz, the pillar that stood on the left of the entrance to the vestibule of the Temple of Solomon, and it's recreated in modern Freemasonry lodges today, symbolizes strength. Jachin, the right-hand pillar, symbolizes wisdom and the act of establishment. When united, they provide stability. In Masonic images, pillars are often surmounted by globes that represent the celestial and terrestrial spheres of existence. That's why I always think a lodge is incomplete unless it has the wands for the stewards and deacons and pillars. And then you get into the wonderful research about where to put them. As well as making the bronze pillars, Hiram of Tyre, the son of a widow, created the sea of bronze. This huge bowl-like receptacle was set on the backs of 12 bronze oxen with groups of three sets at each corner of the compass. The giant bowl was about around 4.5 meters in diameter, 2.4 meters in depth, and was able to hold around 45,000 liters of water. The purpose of this sea of bronze, sometimes called the Brazen Sea or Molten Sea, was to give the priests of the temple a means of purifying themselves through the ritual immersion and cleansing of their bodies. Christopher Knight and Robert Lomas, in their book The Hiram Key, have argued that the mysterious figure of Hiram Abiff is in fact based on the real-life Theban pharaoh Tau II, the Brave. As well as constructing the temple itself, Solomon's builders made enormous efforts to provide the sacred site with the fresh water that was essential to the rituals of purification that were held there. To this huge end, underground cisterns were carved out of the stone upon which stood the citadel known as the Haram, which defended the temple itself. Water was conveyed to the cisterns by a specially constructed aqueduct called Etam, because it was the origin of the flow of water. It has been estimated that one of the stone cisterns said to have been created by Solomon close to the temple was capable of storing 12 million liters of water. Appropriately enough, this underground chamber is referred to as the Great Sea. Work continued at the Great Temple of Solomon for 7 years. According to its Masonic legend, it was at this point that Hiram Abiff was killed. After resolving the circumstance of his death, Solomon continued with the construction of the temple and appointed I made that up. After resolving the circumstance of death, Solomon continued with the construction and appointed newly trustworthy and loyal officers to carry out his work, known as intendants of the building, a title that can still be found at higher levels of Masonic teaching. The temple was finally finished in 960 BC, the 11th year of the reign of Solomon. When the new temple was complete, the Ark of the Covenant was brought from the tent temple called the Holy Tabernacle. You know, the tabernacles were tents, where it had been kept, and was placed in part of the building known as the Holy of Holies, the Kadosh Kadoshim. Before the Ark was put in place, King Solomon assembled all the people of Israel, and they offered innumerable sacrifices of sheep and oxen to God. Once the ark was placed inside, a cloud appeared in the temple and the building was filled with the glory. There followed a feast of dedication that lasted for 7 days. Boy, these boys knew how to party, didn't they? During which prayers were said and sacrifices made, marking a new chapter for the people of Israel and their relationships with God. The first temple, as it is known, survived until 586. BC, of course, when it was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian king. Babylonians took the Hebrews into captivity that lasted until 538 BC, when the Persian king Cyrus defeated the Babylonians. The Hebrews, led by Zerubbabel, returned to Jerusalem, where plans were made for the erection of a new temple. A second temple was begun on the site of the ruins of the first in 515. When the Jewish leader Judah Maccabee took Jerusalem in 164, he ordered that the work be carried out at the temple as it had fallen into a state of disrepair. King Herod also carried out work in the temple until it was finally finished in AD 64. However, this second temple was also destroyed in 70 AD, this time by the Romans. And today, the only part of the Temple of Solomon that still stands is the famous Wailing Wall, which remains a site of pilgrimage and veneration. Oh, sort of fitting that we talk about this more scriptural and history, you know, that blend, more theological, I would say, you know, factual history. So we'll get into Hermes to make up this coming up. A character that I find just fascinating. In the meantime, I want to say goodbye and thank you for joining me today. It's been interesting. It's been fascinating to hear a little bit about the history of Freemasonry, early part of history, me in Canada. I want you to go about your business, of course, committing as many acts of Rand Masonic kindness as you can possibly perform, but more importantly, taking good care of yourself. And until I see you again, I'm going to leave you with something just a little bit seasonal. It's a great time of year. Every single day it's great. Being in your company, I can push all of the bleak thoughts out of my mind and focus on the pleasure of your company. Remember the Epicurean's notion of distracting from unpleasantness and the challenges? Well, you know the challenges are still there. But this is a way of containment. And yes, I perfectly think that it is possible to function in a state of serenity. So you carry on as much as you can with the Christmas spirit. The light comes from within, doesn't it? Have you found it? It comes from within. It's that smile when we see each other, and that immediate, warm, friendly, and endearing handshake. You know it's part of us. I look forward to seeing you soon, in a week. It'll be what, the 22nd of January, of December. Man, we're going to have some fun. We're coming up to 2014. Haven't even mentioned that before. So in the meantime, when you're conspiring, you have a good time. Here's a little tune for you from Vince Guaraldi. I just love this. I think it's seasonal. Enjoy.
for bed. Bacon really might you made. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, that grumble, give a whistle. And this'll help things turn out for the best. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps, just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. Hey,
always look on the bright side of life.
Come on.
Always look on the bright side of life.
For life is quite absurd, and death's the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. Forget about your seat, give the audience a grin. Enjoy it, it's your last chance at the house.
So always look on the bright side of death.
I just
before you draw your terminal breath.
Life's a piece of shit when you look at it. Life's a laugh and death's a joke, it's true. You'll see it's all a show. Keep them laughing as you go. Just remember that the last laugh is on you. And
always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the right side of life.
Come on, Brian, cheer up.
Shandy drinking bastard, your phone is fucking ringing. You gonna pick this bastard out? I tell you, I give you fucking gloves, you kiss you bastard. Hey Jimmy, pick up your fucking phone. I'll kill you, you bastard. I'll fucking kill you.
Ringtone, my.